Thanks for joining us for our latest broadcast with me, Simon Q, Head of Market Engagement, and my colleague, Dave Brooks, who's Head of Policy at Broadstone. Today, we're honoured to have our guest, who is a legend of the pensions industry. It's Mr. Chris Curry, who is heading up the pensions dashboards team. But today, he's here with his PPI, his Pensions Policy Institute hat on. So we welcome Chris to the broadcast. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Simon. Hi, Dave. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. I'll hand over to Dave just to come in with the first question. But in the meantime, Chris, could you give us a brief overview of the PPI, how it came into being and what you do?
Yeah, so the Pensions Policy Institute is an educational research charity. We've been running for 22 years now. So we've been around since before the Pensions Commission. We've been going for quite a while. And we started off, interestingly enough, with an election coming soon. It was one of the first pieces of work that was done for the then new Labour government back in 1997. They set up a group called the Pension Provision Group, which was asked to have a look at the UK pension system and give an overview of some of the issues. Interesting, they weren't asked to make any recommendations. They hadn't gone quite as far as wanting full evidence-based policy making at that stage, but they were interested in the evidence. But the group had found it so difficult to get that evidence together. It was very piecemeal. It was split over a number of different organisations. It wasn't very consistent. That they recommended that an arm's length body be set up to monitor and report back on the pension system to allow there to be better policy making in the future. The government did initially say that was a good idea and we're going to do it. Then they asked the group to do a report on their latest flagship policy, which was the minimum income guarantee. For those of you who've been around pensions long enough, remember it was a means tested benefit on top of the basic state pension towards the end of the 1990s. And the group pointed out that while that was brilliant for current pensioners, it did create quite a problem for saving for pensions in the future, as you'd have to save a lot of money in order to actually get any more money in retirement. And at that stage, the government of the day decided it wasn't such a good idea to have an arm's length body collecting independent evidence around pensions. But the group itself were very keen and so actually set us up as a charity. So the original Pension Provision Group members set themselves up as a charitable board and produced the Institute. I'm not sure that even they envisaged just how long we'd be around for and how successful we would be when we started with one full-time member of staff, a part-time director and a temporary administrator back in 2002. We've grown and actually done very well since then and are now hopefully well established as being the independent voice for pensions and retirement income in the UK.
Yeah, no, I mean, you are a source for good. I do think that is definitely the case, and especially finding that evidence base for what's been going on. But I was also impressed by the speed you got your lifetime provider model analysis out. You know, this was something that was mooted in the autumn, and then all of a sudden you guys actually did some good work on outlining some of the, you know, I think you were fairly non-partisan about it as well, which was nice, because there's a lot of strong words being chucked around in the media, especially around whether it was a good or bad idea and the motivations behind those that perhaps didn't think it was a good idea. But I don't know if that, you want to talk about that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. And it's one that's been, it's a good example, I think, of kind of how almost policymaking is polarised at the moment. Sometimes you get, as with the Pensions Commission and automatic enrolment, and even the state pension age, to a certain extent, there's kind of lots of research that goes on, lots of evidence behind it. And then every now and then a policy idea comes out, which just seems to be an idea and take it from there. And this one in particular, I think was quite polarizing, wasn't it? There were some people who think, yep, this is brilliant. There's great examples of how it works elsewhere. We'd love to do it. It can break up the market a little bit. And then, of course, there's those who see it. Actually, this goes possibly quite against a lot of the direction of travel of policy in recent years. It doesn't really work with the behaviour of individuals. It's going to be a challenge to do it. But this is where I think the PPI really comes into its own, not just for the analysis that we did. And I think, as you say, we were very keen not to make it kind of partisan or to come to any policy conclusions. That's a key theme of what we do. We just provide the evidence and allow other people to draw their conclusions from that. But also the way in which we went about doing it. So actually this was a really good example. We got, I think, about 35 different individuals in a room together for a couple of hours to workshop different angles of the problem, different questions, and to come up with different issues, either advantages or disadvantages of the proposal as we went through. And it enabled us to come up with that report, which I think highlighted some of the things that you'd expect to see around kind of, firstly, you might need to want to see how other policies bed in before you decide whether this is needed or not. You might need to think about, okay, so what's the infrastructure that's needed? How are we going to get the data? How are people going to match all the technical issues? But also, how are we going to support people if they have to make a decision? What processes are we going to put in place for doing that? And so really it allowed us to kind of flush out some of the questions that still need to be answered in the policy, rather than saying, yes, this is a really good thing to do, or no, this is a really bad thing to do. It was actually one of the first lessons I learned working at the PPI, is that whatever the evidence, people will always have a different view as to what the answer is. And so our aim is really just to make sure that everyone's working with the same evidence. Then at least they're arguing about a point of view rather than arguing about what the evidence shows.
Yeah, I think that's quite clear from the research paper that you released. One point that really sort of stuck with me, there are many points, and engagement, you've done another paper on engagement, so we'll come to that in a moment. But if broadly you're dealing with members that are not engaged, they're likely to go with a provider that either has the shiniest advert or a friend recommends down the pub, or... But if it's the shiny advert element, there's a cost to that. And there's only one person that's going to be paying for that, and that's the member ultimately, because the provider isn't going to absorb that cost. They're going to claim it back. They're going to want to make a profit. Yep. And that was something that I didn't think was being picked up more generally, but you certainly did pick it up in that policy paper.
Yeah.
It does. There's often... I don't know, a view of the big picture, rather than thinking that actually this is all about the member at the end of the day.
Yeah, and that again, from our perspective, is really important. As you said, that finding, I don't think it was really earth-shattering. I mean, I think it's one we've seen overseas where they have these type of markets. There is generally a high cost attached to the acquisition of customers, which we don't have in the workplace pension model. And again, as far as I can see in the lifetime provider suggestion so far, there's no real mention of how that would be coped with, how those costs would be contained, what the impacts would be on the individuals of doing that. And as you can see, I think as you were alluding to, having a choice made very early on in someone's career, and that then being something which they stick with, because we know how strong inertia is right the way through, there's real potential for there to be some real detriment to individuals here. So that's not to say the model couldn't work, but it's to say that you really need to think very carefully about how you're going to manage costs and how you're going to encourage people to look at the value they're getting from their provider. They may have been with them for 30 years, but it still might not be the right thing for them to do, and overcoming those hurdles is going to be difficult. So engagement itself, as you said, is a really interesting topic, but even in just something as specific as the lifetime provider model, you can see how important it is to get it right.
Yeah, absolutely. safeguarding people, you know, that's the whole point that I struggle with the lifetime provider model, but also just pensions policy sometimes, is that it's safeguarding people to make sure that whether they are, and we keep alluding to engagement, but whether they are on your loved your engagement kind of metric, with where people are with knowledge and engage with sort of activity and this kind of stuff, wherever you are, the outcomes really ideally from a policy perspective shouldn't be that much different. Yes, if you're engaged, you probably will get better outcomes, but it feels like we want to create a model, or at least a paternalistic model, where whatever the government is telling providers to do is providing those good outcomes without having to have too much engagement. And I think lifetime provider model falls down from that, because people will just, like in the Australia model, you have the host plus, I think it, well, whenever hospitality people go straight into that as their stapled lifetime provider model, and that's it for the rest of their working life, whether that's good, bad, or neutral. So it's that needs to be central, I think.
I mean, it's a challenge, definitely. And to be honest, it's probably one of the key fundamental rationales for having the PPI in doing that. Everything that we do, part of our mission really is to ensure that the work that we do, the evidence that we can provide, can lead to better outcomes for people in retirement. That's what we want to achieve. Sometimes it's quite hard to measure that, because we're not doing it directly. We're not putting policies in place. We're not changing people's lives. on a one-to-one basis, but ideally, if the evidence base is better, if people can look at what the implications are of what's being proposed and use that to come to a better, more informed decision, not to to necessarily do things differently, but to understand what it is they're putting in place and maybe aware what other mitigations might be needed, then that's really us doing our job as best we can. In the lifetime provider model, absolutely the engagement is a really important part of it. And I think if there's one thing that we've learned, certainly in my 22 years at the PPI and before that, working in pensions more generally, is that there's never kind of a single silver bullet, one size fits all solution, which is going to cure all of the problems. I think if anyone had spent any time looking for it, they'd have found it long ago. And if you still spent the past 22 years looking for it, then the chances are it's not going to be around.
Yeah, it's like the answers are always the same in pensions, especially if we talk about adequacy. Anything else, it's always save more, work longer. You know, there isn't really any solution to that, especially in this sort of DC world that we're in. There is, unfortunately, maths wins. That's it.
It is interesting, though, in the past couple of years in particular, I think there's been the kind of surfacing of a third way, I think, which is kind of make the investments work harder. Which is an interesting one, because I think in all of the modelling that we've done as an institute over the past 20 years or so, it's never really featured as being one that really makes a massive difference. It can affect things at the margin, but it's not going to really move the dial, if you want to use a cliche phrase about how it's going to happen. It really does come down to how much money you put in and how long you save and work for that really is the big shift on what your outcomes are likely to be. Sure, there are other things. Costs is another one, but that's, I guess, the flip side of investment return. It's kind of, is it worth getting the high return if it costs more? So it's kind of what the net returns are. But although there are other things that can make marginal differences, I think despite all the attention that there is on different forms of investment or different aspects of investment, shall I say, in the last couple of years, in the last year in particular with the Mansion House reforms, it doesn't appear to me, or the evidence that we've seen with the Institute, that that's necessarily going to have as big an impact as increasing contribution levels or increasing the length of working lives.
Something you said earlier, Chris, around inertia. I mean, you think of how many people have the same bank account that they had when they went to school or university. Dave's indicating for our listener that he's one of them. But it's the incentive, whether it was the rail card or something like that. Incentives concern me as well with potential lifetime provider. Also on that cost element, when that's going to be passed on. So it's I know you say in the paper one way of potentially avoiding the advertising cost and incentives would be to regulate and regulate early. So that's one way around that. But I think there are so many unanswered questions. And of course, we had the Pot Follows member discussion back in Crumbs, when was that, 2012, something like that. Yeah. And that was kind of put on the back burner because auto-enrollment was bedding in. And much as you say, we have pensions dashboards, we've got various other things that need to bed in. Maybe let those bed in first before we then start trying to implement something new.
Yeah, it's always a challenge in pensions policy, isn't it? In that whatever you put in place takes a long time to bed in and to be there. I mean, automatic enrollment is a great example. I mean, when was that first recommended? 2005, and it wasn't until 2018 that we finally got to the full contribution level and the full rollout across all employers. The dashboard is another example of things that take a while, but are worth getting right. And when they do come out and when they're right, they'll make a big difference. So you want to understand what happens there. There's a lot of discussion about consolidation, about small pots. I think you could even look at the freedom of choice reforms that came in 10 years ago now. Surprisingly, hard to imagine it was 10 years ago that came in. They're still not mature. We're still not entirely sure what the impact of those is likely to be. And in that backdrop, trying to add or change or shift additional policies is very difficult because we still don't know exactly what the implications are of what we've already got in place. And we always tend to add something on top of something else rather than removing something and replacing it. So it just means that the system becomes more and more complicated. And even if you think you had an idea of how it might work out because of all the background that's still changing, you never really know. It was a really good example of that actually in another piece of work that we published towards the end of last year, which is our pensions framework, an annual report that's sponsored by Aviva, which I think is one of our most strategic pieces of work, and it's probably going to inform everything we do for the next few years. It tries to take that holistic view over the pension system and bring together those kind of three conflicts that we see in the system around adequacy and sustainability and fairness. You can generally get two of the three, but trying to get all three in one go is virtually impossible. There's a trade-offs involved there. But this year we looked at the impacts of trends in housing tenure. So it wasn't necessarily a change in the pension system, but just how the environment is changing and what that means for the pension system. And the big shifts we're seeing in the numbers of people in private rented accommodation rather than owner-occupiers coming into retirement is likely to have a very significant impact on people's retirement outcomes in the future. I think a 50% increase in the number of people in the private rented sector, which is likely to put a big strain on housing benefit. Higher government costs, potentially increased pensioner poverty as a result of that, the numbers of owner occupiers in retirement going down from over three quarters to less than two thirds. So these are kind of the extremes based on the modelling that we did. But you can see that the landscape might look significantly different just in terms of what housing people have when they come into retirement in the future. And unless we start thinking about what the system or how the system can work with that, what does it mean if there are more renters in retirement? How do we cope with that? What's the right policy response now? If we don't start thinking about it until 20 years' time when it's there, then we're not really going to have time for anything to bed in. So we need to have a good view of what's coming down the track, I think, in pensions in order to start thinking about what the next issue is going to be rather than the current issue.
And you're so right, Chris, to mention connected issues. So housing, the high-profile campaign around leaseholders at the moment and the lack of control that leaseholders have over certain costs, they get to a point where they've got the leasehold, they can't get rid of the leasehold, so they're in this sort of death loop of having to pay these escalating costs that go directly to the freeholder that are dictated by the freeholder. That has a massive knock-on effect to what money is available for saving and ultimately pension provision.
Yeah, absolutely. And it affects people while they're saving and how much they can put aside. But also if they're still there in retirement and having to face those costs, you imagine being on a pension and suddenly having massive increase in the charges that you're facing as part of your leasehold, that could be devastating. We do in the pensions industry, we're very good at looking at things in silos. We focus on the pensions. We look at, okay, so this is how much you need to save for retirement without really thinking about, okay, so how does it fit in with the cost of living? What other issues are there that are going on, like housing, that are likely to affect not just current pensioners, but future pensioners as well? And so we think it's really important that we can take that overall holistic view and try to be a bit more joined up with what we do in pensions. And that doesn't mean we can't focus on pensions issues, which we do most of the time, to be absolutely fair, but you just need to get it in the right context.
Yeah, I mean, Simon and I sometimes forget what I've said to Simon or someone else, but I think as Simon, we've been doing these pensions in 10 videos, and we end up talking about this sort of stuff a lot more than perhaps we would do normally. And we are, I think Simon and I are coming to a view. I don't want to talk for him too much, but I'm sure he'll correct me. But we're coming to a view really where, and I know pensions in my job title and pensions in Simon's job title and your job title, but it feels like that the emphasis that pensions is the answer to everything, perhaps is the wrong question. You know, pensions are great. You know, they are great. Yeah. If you want to retire and have an income, then that's what it's for. And then we have this two-tier system, well, three-tier, but effectively becoming a two-tier system at the least of a single-tier state pension and whatever you can save alongside, and that's great. But the emphasis on getting people in at young ages, I don't know if that's misplaced. You know, do we really want people to be saving for a pension for they might not get for 50 years when there's better use for their money then? You know, this sort of, the pension industry has this very grandiose view of itself that we are the be and end all for people's long-term savings needs. And I think that view needs to change. You know, state pension age keeps rising and you know, longer working lives are longer, then the pension becomes more of the back end. And I just think that is a problem for the pensions industry at the moment, is we're just too fixated on ourselves.
Yeah, there's always a challenge, isn't there? I think as part of that, and I think when you mentioned the state pension age, that's right as well, because one thing we know, despite I think the blip that we're seeing through COVID at the moment, I'd be very surprised if we didn't continue to see increasing life expectancy in the future, which means that there will be more pressure on some age. My children will not thank me for saying this, and if my sons ever listen to this, I mean, they already blame me every time there's a story about state pension age going up. I always get it on WhatsApp. What have you done now? I just like to point out it's nothing to do with me, but it means that the kind of lives are different. People start working later, they're going to keep working for longer, they will die at older ages. I was going to say hopefully, but I'm not sure that sounds right, but I think you know what I mean. And so the kind of the sequences we go through will be different. Having said that, I do think there is still a strong case for looking at pension savings slightly differently, because it is such a challenge for people to think about the long term themselves. I think there is a kind of failure in that respect, that if something isn't done for them, for the vast majority of people, they will leave it too long and too late, and then it'll be too hard to get there. So I think with the current levels of automatic enrolment that we've got, I think we're still probably doing okay. I think if there are increases in the contribution level, full disclosure, obviously, I think the 2017 automatic enrolment review was a great review with some really good recommendations. And if they do start to come through, then I think that's a really good basis on which contribution levels can start to increase. But if contribution levels do start to increase, then I think it's absolutely right to start looking at the balance between what do you need to provide for yourself in retirement, what do you need to provide yourself with financial resilience during retirement. I'm very aware that in my other role for the Pensions Dashboards Programme, it's based in the Money and Pension Service, and they do a lot of debt advice there as well. And the average amounts of saving amongst people, I mean, I think there's 50% of the population have less than a few hundred pounds in savings accessible to them. You look at how precarious that can be, then if there's a way that we can harness the inertia that we're using in pension saving to also have that trickle down into sustainable and resilient saving as well, then I think there's a real opportunity to do that. If all we're doing is getting people to purely save for retirement, then I think that we are potentially not getting that balance right. But I still think people need to start saving early, because if you leave them to their own devices, they're not going to do it. So there's that simplicity argument in there as well. But it's like everything in pensions. It's a trade-off, and you've got to get it right.
Yeah, the benefits of compound interest can't be ignored.
No.
I do wonder if, and we must come on to engagement, because your report on engagement is absolutely superb. But whether we can engage younger people, so people entering the workforce now, by having some kind of metamorphic product that does different things at different life stages. And we have the LISA, LISA, call it what you will, which is pure savings. But if there were a way that could then convert, or proportion of that could convert to pension savings, so you're engaging someone to save for something that's a lot more tangible, but inertia is getting them to save for something that's much more longer term.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost trying to get them to do it without realizing they're doing it, which I guess is where automatic enrollment and workplace pensions is starting from. We it's interesting. We've looked at this in a number of different ways, and that there's generally two different approaches, aren't there? One is you have this product which evolves with you and changes as you change and gives you what you need at the right time. I think the real challenge there is that everybody's different, and so the product needs to be flexible enough to cope with a range of different changes. And generally, where you get flexibility, you get cost, and then it starts to get expensive. The alternative is to either engage and guide or advise people to take advantage of what's already out there, because there is a whole plethora of different products out there that, if you use them in the right combinations at the right time, can easily cope with any situation that you have. It's just knowing what to do and when. But equally, that then takes you into advice and the cost of advice, which everyone can see, and the value of advice, which most people don't see. And how do you get people to do that? So there's a real tension, I think, as to the best way of doing this. And again, I think if we're going to come on to engagement, I think the answer is there isn't a single way that does all of these things. Everybody is different. And that's one of the key findings that we had from that engagement report that we published earlier this year.
Yeah, I think it's probably time that we do come on to that, Chris. So the Institute released their paper, and I was very pleased to be at the launch event in February. I think it was February. Time's going by so quickly. What could effective pensions engagement look like? Do you just want to give our listeners a little overview of how that piece of work came about?
Yeah, so it's a question that's been kind of, I think, bugging us for quite a long time. I mean, as long as I can remember in the pensions industry, engagement has been seen, and I mentioned earlier there wasn't a silver bullet, but engagement has been seen as the silver bullet. This is the thing. If only we can get everybody engaged and everyone can make the right decisions and everyone can improve their outcomes, which is a very lofty ambition and a good ideal if you can achieve it. But we wanted to kind of firstly test that. Is that right? Can engagement solve the issues? And then secondly, what do we actually mean by engagement? Because it's used to cover, and I try to use this, the words in the right way, a multitude of sins when it comes to deciding what to do. In certain places, engagement is talking about, are people making the right investment choices? It can be, are they making the right contribution level? It could be, are they saving? It can cover all of those different things, and people probably sometimes forget that there's a whole range of different levels of engagement that they're talking about. And so what we wanted to do is have a look and say, okay, so what's realistic? What do the levels of engagement look like, and what sorts of people are they applicable for? And of course, as you probably would expect to see, there's a whole range of different types of individuals, ranging from those who are fully engaged, which are the ones we tend to talk about in the pensions industry, because a lot of people in the pensions industry are fully engaged because they understand. So they're the ones where on working groups they say, well, what we really need is this calculator that will allow you to do all these different things, and you can change the actuarial assumption based on what you think personally the markets are going to do, and you'll come up with the right answer. There aren't very many people in that category. You can have the fully engaged, and there are people out there who are engaged, who regularly review what they're doing, look at what they've got, look at what they need, make decisions and change things. But it's a relatively small group. You've got people who are somewhat engaged, who will check in from time to time, but at least have an idea of what's going on. Then you've got the non-engaged, who really probably are vaguely aware that they're in a pension, but know their employer's looking after it for them. And then you've got those who are on the margins, who really know very little and are interested even less in what's going on. And what we've been looking at is kind of what types of engagement work or could work for each of those particular groups. And you have to read the full report to get all of the information from it, but it's a range of things. And as I've kind of given the spoilers already, there isn't a single way of engaging that will work for everybody. And in fact, there are some people for whom engagement is unlikely to work, at least at the stage of their life that they're at now. And that's why things like automatic enrollment, inertia, things like simple rules of thumb, all those kinds of things are really helpful. And as people evolve, as they age, as they get further through their life stages and their financial journeys, then maybe there is an opportunity to shift them along that spectrum into different groups. But starting with the most engaged and working down is probably the wrong way. You need to start with the marginalized and work up.
I usually ban the word engaged or engagement because of its ill definition, and because it means so many different things to different people, and also because I think you describe it as a lofty ambition. I think it's, you know, sort of full engagement in the way that people are, I don't know, with something that people are engaged with, like, think they enjoy. We're never going to get there, and I think people expect, yeah, and again, that's what pensions arrogance sometimes, that, well, people should be looking at this because it's really, really important, and you kind of want to shake them and go, no, but it's really important, but they're still not going to listen. And, you know, how many drivers out there wouldn't know how their car works? You know, they know how to put fuel in it, they know that a light comes on and tells them there's a warning. And I think I've used car analogies, yeah, before when talking about pensions. I think car analogies are really good to help people engage with pensions, to say, look, if you just, you know, obey some of the warning signs that come up, then they're fine. But you do need to engage with those, and that's probably where the analogy breaks down. But I was disappointed to see disengaged Dave, to be honest. I tried not to take it too personally, although I must admit, when I read it again today, I was thinking I might actually be disengaged Dave, if I'm completely honest. You know, high knowledge, low engagement, because, yeah, I don't practice, well, I don't preach it, I suppose, but I don't look at my pension statement very often, if I'm honest. You know, I don't, no. You know, I'm a procrastinator and a delayer and a off-putter, and that's just my personality. And I think, you know, no matter how many times my provider writes to me and emails me and tells me I should look at my statement, I probably, yeah, don't.
And I mean, just to reassure you, you're not unusual. But I don't think, and also to reassure, I don't think we had you in mind. I'll check with the research team just to make sure. But we can add you in next time. We can make sure it is based on you. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you just have to look. I mean, it's been a requirement for pension schemes, money purchase pension schemes, to send out annual statements for I don't know how many years now. And I mean, even myself, I have to own up. I probably opened them. I have a look at what's happened in the past year, what my balance is compared to the previous year, and that's it. Never look at it again. I probably don't even try to work out whether it's been a good increase or a bad increase. It's just, if it's gone up by more than I've paid in, then I'm quite happy. But I've got no idea what that's going to mean for me in retirement. I'm not really sure whether it's enough or not. I haven't spoken to my wife to find out what lifestyle she wants to be kept in when she gets to retirement, so whether I need to increase my saving or not. So there's all these things, and you'd expect kind of people like us who work in the industry to be all over this. But if we don't get around to it because we find more interesting things to do, then the rest of the population, you can be sure, have got a lot more interesting things to do than look at their pensions.
Yeah, there was one part in there with marginalised Maya, and again, for our listeners, go and look at the report because you'll see all this in there. But recognising that actually getting them to give up-to-date contact details would be a win for some people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Dave was touching on this pensions arrogance thing. You then get people going, oh no, but when they do that, we can get them to do this and we can get them to do this. Problem is, you try and get them to do these other things, they go, oh, sod that, I'm not getting involved with that. That's too complicated, and they'll run away screaming from it. So getting people to engage in the way that they want to engage, or the level that they want to engage, is so important.
Absolutely. And if I can switch hats momentarily, I mean, that's one of the reasons why pensions dashboards is plural rather than singular, because we know that individuals aren't going to wake up in the morning and say, oh, I need to look at a dashboard today to work out where my pensions are. But what they might do is check their bank statement online, or they might look at their current balance. And if they can see something there which says, press a button here to find out all your pension arrangements, then there's much more chance they're going to do that. So it's almost kind of encouraging them to be aware of it before actually trying to get them to do anything. And it's that kind of breeding familiarity, I think, that will give us the best chance of at least moving these marginalized people into something where at least they know they're not engaging with something.
I agree. Time is almost against us. We can squeeze another little bit in, Chris.
Okay.
There's potential, well, we're very definitely going to get a general election this year. So there's potential for change. Is there anything that you, or the Institute, I should say, anticipate, if there's any significant change as a result of that? And what's coming down the track from the PPI, either as a result of that or just generally?
Yeah, so it's always difficult with elections, isn't it? I mean, I'd be surprised if there was very much significant around pensions in any manifesto. We already know that the triple lock is going to be in the Conservative manifesto. I'd be surprised if it wasn't in the Labour manifesto as well as all the devolved parties and the Lib Dems. I think that's pretty much nailed on. I don't think that's necessarily a mistake, but I think there is a degree of procrastination in there, in the real question is, what's the state pension for? What should it be providing? And so what level should it be long term? You need to answer that question in order to be able to know when you've got there. And I think that will come eventually, but I don't think that will come before the election. I think there's still a degree of consensus around automatic enrolment, so I wouldn't suggest there was going to be much changing in that space. And I think they're now starting to get a lot of kind of consensus coalescing around mansion house reforms and the idea about investment and pension investment for good, or for Great Britain, depending on how you want to define it. And I think it's an interesting concept. I think there's a lot more work to be done in that space. So I don't really think there'll be an awful lot that's going to be distinguishing between any of the main parties when it comes to pensions. State pension age might be an interesting one. I don't know whether there'll be differences there, but you could see there's the potential for there to be some differences. What we're doing, what I really like to see, and Labour kind of mentioned it a little bit and talked about a review, but it was an internal review. I'd like there to be a kind of a bigger kind of debate again, not necessarily a full commission, but I think at least having some discussion and a holistic view, and ideally using our pensions framework as a backdrop to have a look at some of that, to see how the system might evolve and what gaps might be, and therefore use that as a way to determine policy in the future. And I think at the start of a parliament, you've got a good chance of doing that. But if you leave it too long, you get too close to elections again, and anything substantial has to wait till the next one. We will be analysing manifestos when they come out. We'll be hopefully holding some hustings events to give people an opportunity to hear from the horse's mouth, as it were, what the different positions are. Hopefully there'll be enough difference between them for it to be interesting. That there generally is when it comes to politicians. There's always something they can find to disagree on, and we're hoping that by doing that we can help again improve the evidence base and people's understanding of what the different parties may well mean for pensions after the election. I don't really think there's a massive vote winner for any particular party in pensions. There might be a vote loser, but I don't think there's anything that's going to attract a lot of people.
That does sort of bring us back to where we started with the PPG report you were noting at the beginning, because this was commissioned by the Labour Party soon after they came in. New Labour, after a long period of Conservative rule, in they came, and this brought through quite a few changes, albeit a couple of commissions later and a few other things. But what you're, I know you noted at the top, but I was just interested in your thoughts because I know you were involved with it in that production of it, and some of the key themes from that might echo. How many years later? I'm not very good at maths. 30-odd years later, nearly.
Yeah, I think it's right. It's still very relevant. And as I said, it led to the birth of the PPI. So it's a report I kind of hold in very high esteem. I was still a kind of a civil servant back in those days. So I was in charge of providing the analysis that went into the report in 1998, including the kind of the 30-year projections almost that we had in there. So it was the first time the department had used this particular model to project forward to 2025. I said, I'm not going to look next year to see how close we got, because there's been a lot of changes since then. But I think some of the key elements about the need for a firm foundation in the state pension was important. And of course, after that report, we had a number of different iterations. The state second pension came in, which was deliberately targeted to increase the pension provision for the lower paid as part of that, which has now evolved again into the single tier pension. And the importance of saving on top of that, which I think initially led to stakeholder pensions as the kind of the first policy response beyond that, which eventually then evolved into automatic enrolment. You can see that there was a lot of very key themes that still hold, I think, today. Interestingly, there were two other reports which came out after that looking at specific issues. One was women and pensions, which I think is still just as big an issue today as it has been. And we do lots of work in that with Now Pensions and others looking at the gender pension gap. And the other was the self-employed, which are probably the main group that haven't benefited from automatic enrolment, and which we're really, to be frank, struggling in policy terms to think about how we can replicate the benefits of automatic enrolment for that group. They were seen as a difficult challenge then. They're still a difficult challenge now. So in some ways, those themes endure.
Yeah, sorry, I was going to make those similar points, actually, because when I was reading through it this morning, and also, you know, ways of encouraging people to save. You know, you talked about it in there as well, about the ability of the low paid to afford the necessary contributions. These are just age old problems. Yeah. And it goes back to your mythical silver bullet, you know, from before. You know, that these, I don't know whether these problems will just dog pensions forever. Oh, God, I'm really depressed at the end. Sorry, but it does feel like these are just the age old things. But just, you know, we're talking earlier about engaged people and how the industry tends to focus on them, obviously, because, you know, as a money making thing, you want to talk to people who are going to talk back. But whether they just, there is a slight concern for me anyway that I want the state to perhaps be a bit more paternalistic about the pensions again and have another reset rather than relying on employers, who I think may be getting a bit disillusioned with pensions if people can spend it too soon and not have a retirement to retire on, which is the point. They probably, they offer it as a benefit. You know, whether the state should be getting involved a little bit more to encourage people to save or help them in other ways.
Yeah, it's a recurring theme. It comes back to balance, doesn't it, as to what it is you're trying to achieve and the best way to achieve that particular aim. And I think the real challenge when it comes to the government and governments of all kinds in recent years have started to push more towards this being a private sector solution rather than something the state can do, probably because of the view of taxation that we have in this country and how it works or doesn't work, depending on how you look at it. But in order for a private sector solution to work, you really need to align the incentives. So the private sector exists for a particular reason. They're generally there to make money. That's what the private sector does. But if you can find a way for them to make money and to meet the needs of the population, then you've got a system that has a chance of working. And so I think any time the government comes up with, this is what I think we could do in the private pension space, they need to be looking at, okay, so how would it work for individuals? And does it mean that if the industry behaves as we'd expect them to behave, and as you'd expect any private sector organisation to behave, is that going to achieve what we want them to do? And if you're expecting them to act altruistically or paternalistically, then that's going to be a challenge. And I think it's not impossible, but it's not something which is going to be widespread across every industry player. So you need to be very aware of that.
Well, Simon, as you noted, time is run out for our conversation with Chris. So thank you, Chris, for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we hope you've enjoyed the conversation, and we look forward to seeing you again on the next episode of The Broadcast.